This is East End Inc. Tonight we present poet Philip Schultz reading from Luxury, his latest collection, recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. He was introduced by poet and teacher Grace Shulman. She is Distinguished Professor of English at Baruch College of the City University of New York.
In every one of his books and poems, Philip Schultz has startled me with the music of his lines, by the wealth of his language, and the range of his thought. Every time I say excitedly, this is even better than the last. Like Wings, which earned a National Book Award nomination, Deep Within the Ravine, which won the Lamont Award of the Academy of American Poets, Failure, which won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, The Wherewithal, his astonishing novel in verse, and on. And now Luxury, his newest, is the most powerful of all. The poems reveal the heartbreak of simply being alive, when ghosts of the past whisper death. The joy of present love for family and friends breaking through but not quite banishing those ghosts. In Luxury, he looks deeply into the self, examining the sources of what we do with our lives. And that is the story of his work, self-revelation, despite what he calls art's aesthetic parenthesis, a self-knowledge gained from and despite early loss. In Luxury, he writes of enjoying everyday mundane details with his gifted wife, Monica, his grown children, neighbors, and dogs, while all the while thinking about Pythagoras or St. Augustine, Montaigne or Bismarck. He contemplates inner realities while simultaneously dwelling on current events, the Women's March, Afghanistan, and in a bitterly ironic poem called Sacrifice, the horror of the terrorist psychology, a photo of a woman smiling at the man she's about to obliterate, of a boy walking brusquely toward his fate. He goes to an inner place of pain to consider the suicides of a boyhood friend and, above all, of his unfortunate father. From there, he contemplates the great Paul Celan and Hemingway in ways that their self-inflicted deaths have taught him to live. Meditating at Hemingway's house, he realizes that he lives perpetually on the edge of grace and death. Teetering there, he portrays a life lived to the fullest, with humor, sadness, and joy, temporal distractions, and permanent truths. Finally, he achieves a vision of ugliness so profound as to reveal beauty. At its supreme height, it is how, he writes, the thrust and pulse of wind instructs geese and swans on the physics of flight, where land and sea begin and the sky ends, and clouds perform dream symphonies in the raucous applause of the waves. This is an art of the self that can save us all. Please help me welcome the poet Philip Schultz.
This is a poem, Welcome to the Springs. You've probably all seen that sign. The dispersion and reconstitution of the self, that's the whole story, Charles Baudelaire. In memory of Robert Long. Here I am at your grave again. Often enough, driving around East Hampton, taking shortcuts you taught me, this is where I end up. Okay. But it's been 10 years, and I'm still not sure what the Baudelaire quote on your stone means. The soul's endless search for resolution, our need to constantly redefine our illusions. you know and won't say. What you don't know is that we divided your things. I got the Tiapolo poster and Elizabeth Bishop's Geography 3, noting her preference for undercutting the tragic with a parenthesis. By the way, there's a bright red Mercedes in your driveway. You, who always just got by. And your favorite sign, Welcome to the Springs, is now at the center of a local controversy. Some want to drop the thee and just say Springs. Imagine that. Monica's new sculpture has grown darker, as you said it would. He did. Eli is happy at Amherst, and Augie likes to write. What a surprise. Well, I've forgiven you, finally, for not living to see the book you helped me write get published. Only now do I understand that it's not the resentment I regret, it's the shame. Us, the oddest of sympathies, poetry friends, vying for attention, encouragement. You, sober 6 years, a historian of the art scene out here on the East End of Long Island. I, married with small kids, each writing again after a long silence. Write about this place, you'd say. Find its soul. Make it yours. Yes, the ever-evolving, ever-munificent light all your painters came here for. De Kooning, biking drunk down Springs Fireplace Road, calling, Good night, Robert. Best of luck. Hey, last night on TV, Bogart, playing a drunken mercenary hiding out as a priest, was told to seek sympathy among his own kind. Well, all your personas, ex-drunks, art critics, musicians, cooks, and poets came to your funeral. Good food and music, but not much to say. What role did I play that last night, watching you, high on morphine, drop cigarettes into your lap, swooning inside a cancer and Coltrane-stained oblivion? What can I do, you asked. There's nothing I can do. Well, what didn't you do? Chauffeuring James Brown from Harlem to Montauk, high on Librium you got from a Chelsea speed freak, cooking your manic bouillabaisse stuffed with half the Atlantic Ocean, spoon dancing Getz and Bud Powell, swollen with vodka and dreams of Venice, your dinner riffs to Lipo, Machado, and Blake. How I liked your stories of you, a gay teenager, wandering among your MoMA pals Goya, Rauschenberg, and Francis Bacon, learning to hide inside art's ecstatic parentheses. In any case, it's March, warm and wet and windy, and this is where I live, here, where everything lives in the eye and the ear, and a silky frenzy steeps the wetlands in testimony, in praise, where the mating calls of osprey ricochet between the loquacious silence of the dunes and the cleansing sweep of moonlight, where the souls of the dispersed dead pass, making and remaking their silhouettes, one luminous lost imagination at a time. The Woman's March. So many mothers are here, daughters and granddaughters. Mine's been dead for 19 years, but somehow managed to come. I'm seeing her everywhere, in the pleased with itself smile of a little girl riding her father's shoulder, holding a sign announcing girl power and the beginning of the woman's century. In the don't mess with me look of the much pierced young woman in black, who appears to have finally found her cadence, in the excited gray-green eyes of the old woman in a wheelchair being pushed along at quite a clip by, I assume, her grandson, who looks absolutely mesmerized, And just ahead is the forceful stride of the black drummer banging away for all she is and wants to be, using everything she has to make a point about strength and willfulness and sacrifice that maybe only women have the right to make, having made all of us, shared themselves so completely. A point about going too far and not far enough, about time and the pain it brings. And yes, here I am, older than I ever intended to be, enjoying the ringing in my ears, remembering being lifted into the air by my mother, trembling with joy as she enfolded me into the hospitable wings of her peasant apron. Yes, she's here, marching with all the others, all of whom understand what's being asked of them. One more time. IGA. It's 1 week after Sandy and Mrs. Cobb, our mailman's aunt, who lived in the Halloween house on Cheryl Street that burned down, is ahead of me in line, hands in her hair, screaming. Betsy, the cashier, is telling the assistant manager, Peggy, that all she did was say her peaches aren't the ones on sale. Mr. Brim, the sourpuss who owns the pizzeria on North Main, yells from behind me, "Just give her the damn peaches. A dead deer's on my garage, my backyard's a lake, we're all still at my sister-in-law's and I'm not hollering my head off." I offer to pay and Betsy snorts, "You?" Because 2 years ago I refused to make a third donation to her Baptist choir, and her God isn't the forgiving kind. Now Rudy, the manager, is here, angry not to be among his friends, the chips and donuts in aisle six. "Good," Mr. Brim groans. "Now everyone's here." Actually, almost everyone is here. JJ, the deli air drummer who hums R&B and slices everything thin. Fergus, the cart gatherer whose tattoos depict angry biblical patriarchs. And Benny in produce, who lost 84 pounds eating sardines and Cocoa Puffs and has iPhone photos to prove it. All come to see if this is another catastrophe that will keep us up all night, watching our kids sleep in the living room, praying for the wind to stop, the roof to hold, that last insurance bill got paid, fearing our ignorance and pettiness is to blame, that if we were just a little more humble in the hearing and sublime in the doing, as St. Augustine suggested, we could all go back to sleep, only one donation and the right peach shy of deliverance. Googling ourselves. "You think yourself wise, proud Zarathustra. Then guess the riddle. Speak then. Who am I? These strangers with my name, busy being kidnapped, embezzled, honored, and dying at a frightening rate. The cross-dressing exterminator convicted of rape in Kensington, Ohio, sentenced to 72 years without bail. The policeman killed stopping a burglary in Thermopolis, Wyoming. Could they have imagined a Florida painter with their name communicating with extraterrestrials through sculptures made out of railroad tracks or being written about in a poem by another member of their redundant family for a reason none of us can explain? Sometimes I fear I'm imaginary, don't really exist. Catch myself wondering why I only seem to like myself when, say, I'm wearing a teacher's face, because I see myself only through others' eyes. In that case, who am I, really? Alone at night watching a ball game, I'm always surprised when I speak to myself in third person, wondering why this man cares so much about something he plays no part in. It's easier to wonder why Nietzsche sought his soul's sympathy, a truth he knew he'd despise, probably feared he wouldn't survive, To imagine him up late seeking his ever-evolving, unidentifiable self, a past more inhabitable and less unforgiving, anxious to know why someone with his name would say, "Poets lie too much. Who among us has not adulterated his wine?" Late at night, the web is a dangerous swamp of voyeuristic self-scrutiny and addictive impersonation. The ego testifying for and against itself, seeking evidence of triumph and complicity, sanctioned without malice, pretext, or God. Who is this man obsessively looking up all his persona narrators, feeling like a hodgepodge, trapped somewhere between heaven and earth, spitting against the wind? Is it because he knows he's getting closer to the end, will soon vanish and become nothing? Is this why he's studying everyone who answers to his name? Because one may have invented time or sympathy or God and will love him even momentarily for who he is.
This is East End Inc. on WPKN Radio. This unique program is heard only on WPKN. Please take a minute to go to WPKN.org and click on the donate button. Thank you. We're listening to poet Philip Schultz reading from his latest collection, Luxury. Next is the title poem.
Sometimes a hidden memory or thought flings my right arm forward, and I'll recoil, as if struck by an invisible blow, and cry out. It's over in a moment, but the cry, elemental, fearful, and contrite, lingers like a scent of decay. That's when all that has yet to happen is erased by what already has. Saturday nights I went to hear R spin infinite spools of biblical jazz prophecy out of a miserable bar piano in our college town, the kind that makes the floor weep and the ceiling grieve. R believed his pain was supreme, that he was king, being the son of a white mom and the black man she cheated on her white husband with. Given his slave papers and set adrift at 8 in foster homes because, she explained, he was too much of one thing and not enough of another. Thus, he became an orphan stillborn, obsessed with white women, the kind that came to hear him use his genius to hate himself and hate them. Up there, deep inside, each sullen puff of his cigarette, his inner voice, up-tempo, dot-time scale riff coming from so far down. The only question left was how much longer pain would sustain him. He could live on nothing. This Christmas, a 70th birthday present, my wife and two sons took me to Finca La Viaga, Hemingway's house in San Francisco de Paula, Cuba, where I, among tourists from Canada, China, and Sweden, was utterly happy, peering through fragile windows at roped-off furniture, belligerent trophy heads, decaying books and photos of matadors and movie stars, a ghostly royal portable typewriter, all the vexed memorabilia of death's foremost connoisseur. Yes, Hemingway, whose stories I read while Dad was dying, about fathers and sons, codes of honor, and gracious appetites, the kind of stories I wanted to write, with luminous sentences unafraid to embrace the simplicity of grief and disgrace. Hemingway, who, like my father and R, chose death, would show me how to live. Sometimes, this is the beginning of section two, sometimes a noise I can sense but not hear ricochets in a place in me I can't name. That's when the darkness accentuates all my feelings of guilt and shame, and I'm unable to distinguish between misery and nothingness. When all dignity vanishes and nothing is left to say or do, be curious about or desire. When my mother's voice pleads for me to remember everything I live for. Once in 1972, after not having spoken in months, R called to say, a big black bird perched on his shoulder every time he tried to write, questioning his every instinct and desire to make something out of nothing, even his right to console himself. Neither poetry nor music would save him, it said. He was only forestalling the inevitable, placating a grief that would eventually defeat him. I didn't know what to say, so I quoted Unu Munu. Self-compassion widens into love of all that lives and therefore wants to survive. Each embryo was a phenomenon, Unu Munu said, of singular longing, a turning away from the dark coil of agony. Please, I pleaded, remember the first time his black foster mother placed his fingers on a keyboard, the astonishment he felt in each note, the joy of feeling original and alive. Music was his birthright, not pain. Please, I pleaded, ascent to rhapsody, the angels of revelation, shun this black bird of nothingness. Yes, he said, he understood. But he didn't call to be saved. He called to say goodbye. Sometimes when something I fear cannot tolerate something I desire, I'll wince and shudder and shout out, as if confronted with an idea or thought or feeling I cannot accept. Then, at the center of a pause I never felt before, a voice will remind me of things I do poorly, mistakes I cannot forgive. Sometimes, unable to breathe or feel my hands or feet, a void inside me slowly fills with the sobriety and brilliance of shame. This is when a blackbird perches on my shoulder, asking me to stop thinking, stop talking and dreaming, to stop, simply just stop. The turtle crossing Old Stone Highway this morning may not yet have arrived at its destination, should one exist. Perhaps one shouldn't interfere with the struggles of a species not his own. Sisyphus's dilemma was human, after all. Sympathy is ancient and often hopeless, an enterprise as instinct and desire. Out here in spring, a high frequency of wings, the dissonance of unbridled wind, the endless walking and running along windy rows and blind curves, the wild, uninhibited willfulness of anxious new life. Yesterday, a man riding his bike was killed when a deer hit by a pickup flew into him from across the road. Bad luck, Murphy's Law, or a logic so perverse as to be absurd? Perhaps they shared, this man and deer, a love of fields of tall grass, cul-de-sacs, and back roads leading nowhere, a belief in family, loyalty, and the common good. Love the dusk equally. My sons came to this tiny cemetery under the windmill to play tag after music school across the street. I come to walk among the nearly illegible stones of Puritan settle makers and true believers. The Millers, Osbornes, and Hedges are original neighbors. To visit Mary Hunting, dead June 5, 1779, married over 200 years to Nathan, third cousin to Adeline S., wife to Jeremiah T. Parsons, Jr., and the good Reverend Milford Osborne, who no doubt provides guidance still. Perhaps it's best not to wonder if their joy equaled their suffering, what sins, if any, were forgiven, if they believe their arduous, brief lives, forged out of water, woods, and stubborn skies, were worthy of gratitude. Here, under four fixed blades, stirring nothing but time, within earshot of Main Street and the summer uproar, this quaint, beautiful place offers no place to sit, though my shadow provides a little shade. Osiris is the driver in Cuba. Osiris is driving us up the side of a mountain to an orchid farm in Sorora. saying, "This is the most magical place in this disappointed land. Indeed, a glittering garden of 20,000 orchid plants winding up and around respectful roots and ornamental ferns and trees. Stubbornly alive butterflies, 80 species of birds and the world's smallest frog. A sweetness overflowing the beautiful name our guide Hermosa sings. Paraphidelium, Archelaus, Cicinia, Vanda Blue, Brassia, Peggy Ruth, Phalaenopolis, Mystic, and Waterfall Pansy. And there inside this labyrinth of hot light, these phosphorus spheres, us, a man and wife and two fervent young men, a family like any other, relishing the capacity of such improbable blossoms, each a promise of splendor, another hour of fever, a voluptuous awakening, a refuge from the despair stowed in the mind." Now, from across the house, the booming voice of my 16-year-old son announcing his belief in the law and right of succession, the beginning of his reign. Already too big for this house, it conspires with a future that is his alone. My wife, a sculptor, looks up from her porcelain cakes arrayed over the living room table, which, even with the dead birds and beetles and tiny people writhing on top, are festive enough. While I, standing in the kitchen, pondering questions about guilt, satisfaction, and lunch, remember leaning against the sycamore in our front yard 26 years ago, trying to imagine a family inside the house I just bought, a future prolific enough to contain squawking black birds, flying deer, and a notion as mysterious and improbable, as fragrant and luxurious as happiness. Thank you.
This is East End, Inc. We heard Philip Schultz reading from Luxury, published in 2018 by W.W. Norton, recorded in April 2018 at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. He was introduced by poet Grace Shulman. The complete reading is available at eastendinc.blogspot.com, along with Mr. Schultz reading from his previous work. Here are some upcoming literary events produced by Canio's Cultural Cafe at 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor, all at 5 p.m. On Friday, May the 25th, author Mary Cummings presents her true crime book, Saving Sin City. William Travis Jerome, Stanford White, and the Original Crime of the Century. On Saturday, May the 26th, novelist Rachel Lyon reads from her critically acclaimed debut novel, Self-Portrait with Boy. On Saturday, June the 2nd, Sag Harbor author Glynn Hiller presents her memoir, Passport to Paris. And on Saturday, June the 9th, Charles Fishman reads from In the Wake of the Glacier, new and selected poems. More events are listed at canyosbooks.com. East End, Inc. returns next Wednesday with the East Hampton Library Poetry Group. East End, Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com, where you'll find a link to East End, Inc. podcasts. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendro and Catherine Zocca. This is Hazel Kahn.